Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I'm reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Thursday, February 22nd. College Rodeo 40th Anniversary OC Rodeo to take place this week. This week, the Odessa College Rodeo will celebrate its 40th anniversary from February 22nd through 24th at Ector County Coliseum. Each performance will start at 7 p.m. Competitors from 18 colleges and universities across Texas and New Mexico will compete in such events as bareback, saddle bronc, barrel racing, goat tying, steer wrestling, team roping, bull riding, and more. Sophomore Spencer Denayer, who takes part in the bareback competition, will be one of the many Odessa College Wranglers competing this week. I've been bareback riding since I was a freshman in high school, Denayer said. Denayer, who is from Brownlee, Nebraska, is excited to be competing in the 40th anniversary of the Odessa College Rodeo. I think it's outstanding, Denayer said. I'm lucky to be here during an anniversary year. That's something special that you have to take advantage of, and I think all of us will take advantage of it. Denayer talked about the difficulties of his event. It's the first event, Denayer said, of the bareback riding. Many say it's the most demanding. It's pretty rough. He talked more about what brought him to Odessa College. Odessa College really stood out to me, Denayer said. I knew I wanted to go out somewhere in West Texas. This is one of the toughest regions in rodeo. Another veteran on the team is Kennedy Myers, who competes in the breakaway and team roping. I've been getting ready for this rodeo since the beginning of the season, Myers said. All season, we've been prepping for each rodeo, and this one is a big one. Myers, who is a junior from Beach, North Dakota, said it's special to be at home for this week's rodeo. It's always special to be home for our home rodeo, Myers said. You never know what's going to happen. It's in our home territory. Myers also discussed the mental aspects of competing in rodeo. Mentally, our coach, Tom Kelly, has been helping us out, Myers said. We watch videos and read books that he tells us about. Rodeo is 99% mental. You have to keep a good headspace. We practice out here all year long. It's just a mental preparation that we need to be ready for. During the Saturday evening performance, Odessa College Rodeo team alumni and former coaches will be recognized. The Odessa College Rodeo program has built legend in the sport with alumni including Ty Murray, Jim Sharp, Adam and Gilbert Carrillo, Jerome Davis, Cimarron Gerke, Dustin Bowen, Kai Hamilton, Tristan Hutchings, and Colton Hevelo. For tickets and more information about this year's Odessa College Rodeo, go to https://www.wranglersports.com/general/2023-24/releases/20240108GCE3JC. Tips to get high cholesterol under control. Family features. Health disease is the nation's leading cause of death for men and women, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But many people aren't aware they may be at elevated risk. More than 71 million adults in the United States have high, low-density lipoprotein LDL cholesterol, and nearly 50 million don't have it under control, which puts them at higher risk for cardiovascular events such as heart attack and stroke. What's more, nearly one-third, 31% of U.S. adults are not aware that having high cholesterol puts them at greater risk for heart attack and stroke, according to the findings of a recent study conducted by the Harris Poll, commissioned by Esperion Therapeutics Incorporated. The poll also revealed some inconsistent understanding about treatment options available for those with uncontrolled cholesterol. Fully 3 in 10, 30% of those taking statins believe statins are the only LDL-lowering treatment available for those with high LDL cholesterol. In auto racing, the red flag means danger on the track, stopping the race immediately, said Dr. Joanne Foody, Chief Medical Officer at Esperion. We are launching a patient education program, Wave the Red Flag, to encourage people with uncontrolled high cholesterol to have their levels checked right away and discuss appropriate treatment options with their healthcare provider. If your high cholesterol is uncontrolled, understanding how you can achieve greater control can reduce your risk for serious health conditions, including potentially life-threatening cardiovascular events. Consider these tips to get high cholesterol under control. Talk with your doctor. Speaking with your physician is an important first step to managing any health condition. Your doctor can help you understand the severity of your condition and whether a treatment plan should be moderate or aggressive. Check your progress. Keeping tabs on your cholesterol can help you and your healthcare team gauge whether your treatment plan is working. If you don't have heart disease, you may not need to check as frequently, but your doctor can recommend the appropriate intervals to help manage your cholesterol most effectively. Take medication as prescribed. Statins are the medication most often recommended by treatment guidelines for the management of high cholesterol, and nearly one-third, 30% of those taking statins believe they have the only high cholesterol-lowering treatment available, according to the survey. However, even with maximal statin therapy, some patients with chronic disease do not meet recommended LDL cholesterol levels. Taking your medication regularly and as instructed helps your doctor determine whether additional therapies, including non-statin treatments, could be useful to help manage your blood cholesterol. Make lifestyle adjustments. Your diet plays a major role in lowering LDL cholesterol. Limiting fatty foods, especially those that are high in saturated and trans fats, is key. Monitoring your overall diet and exercising can also help reduce your risk of high cholesterol. Even if you don't have high cholesterol, adopting more cholesterol-friendly habits can help you prevent your levels from rising to unhealthy levels in the future. To find additional information about managing your high cholesterol, talk to your healthcare provider and visit wavetheredflag.info. Fast facts about cholesterol. What is cholesterol? The liver creates a fatty-like waxy substance called cholesterol. It serves useful purposes for the body, including producing hormones and helping digest food. How do you get high cholesterol? The human body makes all the cholesterol it needs naturally, so any cholesterol you eat is cholesterol you don't need. However, it can be difficult to avoid because you find dietary cholesterol in many common foods, including meat, seafood, poultry, eggs, and dairy. Other non-dietary contributing factors include health conditions like obesity and diabetes, as well as family history and advancing age. What is a normal cholesterol level? An average optimal level for LDL cholesterol is about 100 milligrams per deciliter mg over dl. An average optimal level of high density lipoprotein or HDL cholesterol is at least 40 mg over dl for men and 50 mg dl for women. HDL cholesterol can actually lower your risk of heart disease and stroke. What are these symptoms of high cholesterol? Unlike many health conditions, there are rarely any symptoms that your cholesterol is high. That makes regular screening so important. Odessa man facing felony drug charge. An Odessa man was arrested Tuesday on a felony drug charge after detectives received a tip and launched an investigation. According to an Odessa Police Department report, detectives received information Joshua Tavares was selling meth, and they obtained a search warrant for his house in the 2800 block of Henderson Avenue after using a myriad of investigative techniques that resulted in the seizure of more than 290 grams of the drug. During the search, detectives found packaging, digital scales, more methamphetamine, and two guns, one of which had been reported stolen in Midland County, the report stated. Tavares was arrested on suspicion of manufacture, delivery of a controlled substance, a first-degree felony, and theft of a firearm. Tavares is being held in the Ector County Jail on a parole violation charge. U.S. Marshals hold and surety bonds totaling $95,000. Biden's LNG move called blatantly political. Russia applauds halt of American LNG projects. President Biden's recent freeze on U.S. Department of Energy permits for new liquefied natural gas projects has weakened the United States' national security. That's according to the Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association and Waco economist Ray Perryman, who says Biden's decision has also brought American reliability into question. Across the world, U.S. oil and natural gas is in high demand, TIPRO President Ed Longenecker said from Austin. Our local producers provide the most efficient, affordable energy sources, and it's up to us to supply our allies in need. Limiting our ability to deliver critical resources not only hinders our national security, but also sends a negative message that the United States is an unreliable business and trading partner, he said. Whether the jurisdiction of exports is under DOE or the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the industry will maintain its commitment to meet energy demands and provide a secure energy future for all. Congressman August Pfluger last Thursday won passage in the House of Representatives in Washington for his Unlocking Our Domestic LNG Potential Act of 2024, which was sent to the Senate to abrogate Biden's decision and transfer permitting authority to the FERC. Pfluger's bill would also reverse Biden's prohibition of LNG exports to nations with which America does not have free trade agreements. Perryman said the pause on permitting is harmful not only to the energy industry, but also to energy security, geopolitical stability, and ultimately climate initiatives. Russian media is actually celebrating the U.S. decision and the short-sighted move, it clearly helping Russia to maintain its economic stability and political influence, Perryman said. The United States has recently become the leading exporter of LNG, and the market has been expanding significantly in both Europe and Asia. When Russia invaded Ukraine, the dangerous dependency of Europe on Russian natural gas became abundantly obvious, as some of us have been talking about for decades. One of the projects affected by the permit pause is already committed to supply natural gas to Germany. American allies in Europe and elsewhere are investing billions in needed infrastructure to allow them to regasify LNG from a source they had assumed was reliable, and the U.S. pause is causing deep concerns. Perryman said Biden's move also enhances the investment risk exposure associated with the development of domestic LNG facilities. Although climate change is a critical issue which must be dealt with, many well-meaning activists have failed to recognize that every credible analysis, including those of the Department of Energy, shows that even as other forms of energy rapidly expand their footprint, the world will require more oil and natural gas in 2050 than it does today, he said. Perryman said the irony in the moratorium is that the expedited development of LNG facilities is beneficial to climate efforts in that much of the expanded exports would facilitate replacing coal or higher carbon natural gas from other areas for power generation facilities. Without a doubt, politics should be taken out of a decision to pause, said an Congressman Pfluger's bill to place authority with FERC is a positive step, he said. Our firm has performed the economic analysis for many of the current permitted plants throughout the U.S., and FERC has consistently evaluated applications on the merits, including impacts on the U.S. economy under multiple administrations. Any president can be swayed at times by influencers, donors, and polls, but an agency like FERC is less likely to get caught up in political considerations related to LNG and focus more on responsible energy development. Beware of signs and symptoms of sepsis. If you've watched enough episodes of Grey's Anatomy, then you've probably seen that some patients develop sepsis and die. Dr. Bharath Ragaswamy of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center said, the word sepsis itself can provide the warning signs for what can be a mortal condition. S, shortness of breath. E, extremely cold hands or feet. P, palpitations, a racing heart. S, slurred speech. I have never felt so bad. S, shivering uncontrollably. Sepsis is an overwhelming body reaction to any infection, and sepsis is a life-threatening condition. Ragaswamy said, if not diagnosed early and not treated, it can cause significant mortality and morbidity. Some quick facts about sepsis in America. Around 1.47 million people have sepsis every year. Sepsis, when it gets more severe, which we call septic shock, has 30 to 60% of death rate. One in three deaths that happen in a hospital setting is related to sepsis. So sepsis needs a significant awareness among public as well as the general practitioners and healthcare workers to prevent the damage. Any infection can cause sepsis, he said. When a bacterial infection goes untreated, most commonly it progresses into sepsis. Viral infection, such as COVID-19 and fungal infections, can also progress into sepsis. Any infection which is uncontrolled can progress into sepsis, said Ragaswamy, who is an assistant professor and assistant clerkship director at the Health Sciences Center. He added that sepsis can occur at any age. Even young and healthy people can have an infection that is uncontrolled. It goes on into severe sepsis and septic shock, he said. But the most vulnerable patient population is the elderly, age 65 and older, and people who have a weakened immune system. For example, people with cancer, patients who are on chemotherapy for cancer, which weakens the immune system, patients with chronic medical conditions, diabetes, especially when it's uncontrolled, chronic lung condition, COPD, asthma, and chronic kidney disease. These are the patient population who are at risk of sepsis. What happens in sepsis is your normal body's immune response goes into a chain reaction. It causes a lot of harmful things. Your blood pressure is going to drop down to dangerous levels because your blood circulation can be affected. Organ systems can be affected, he said. You can have organ failure, tissue damage. You might have heard about patients with sepsis losing their limbs. So those things can happen due to less blood supply. Those are some of the manifestations of sepsis. The common symptoms of sepsis are increased heart rate, fever, cold and clammy skin, shortness of breath or rapid breathing, confusion or disorientation. A common misconception among the public is that sepsis means bacteria is in the blood, but any infection can cause sepsis, Ragaswamy said. a skin, lung, or urinary tract infection can progress into sepsis. Ragaswamy added that healthcare providers need to diagnose the ailment as soon as possible and get people into the hospital to prevent death. Some of the symptoms mimic a bad flu, so sometimes you may think that I'm just having a bad flu, and you may just keep pushing through without getting proper medical attention, he said. When your flu is not getting better the second day and third day, when you start getting new symptoms, shortness of breath, palpitations, hands and feet becoming cold and clammy, and you get confused, those are the warning signs you need to go to the doctor or call 911 to get yourself checked out. Why is it so important that we need to get ahead of sepsis? Timely management includes a timely antibiotic. Every hour counts. Every hour we delay, administration of antibiotics increases the death rate in sepsis. When the patient comes to the hospital, the doctors are going to give them antibiotics, mostly through an IV, so that it acts faster. They're going to give them IV fluids. They're going to check the blood and test for bacteria. They may check any of their body fluids to check for infection. These are some sophisticated blood tests to rule out. Those tests need to be done in a timely manner, and the antibiotics need to be administered in a timely manner to prevent that. He emphasized that people should take any infection seriously. If you have any suspicion that the infection is not getting better, it's not a good idea to sit on that and push through and wait for a longer time until it gets worse. That's when bad things happen, he said. So early medical attention is crucial. Prevention is better than cure. Vaccination cannot cure sepsis, but it can potentially prevent the diseases which can progress into sepsis, for example, flu and pneumonia shots. Getting these vaccinations helps us get ahead of sepsis. Practicing good hygiene, including hand washing and proper dental hygiene, are also important. Ragaswamy said, adding, that when a dental infection occurs, there is a risk it could progress into a dental abscess that could eventually lead to further serious infection. And he said, if you have an underlying health condition like uncontrolled diabetes, you're at an even higher risk. So preventing infection in the first place, and if the infection happens, taking care of the infection timely and correctly, he said. Do not self-administer or self-medicate yourself with antibiotics. I've seen this sometimes, self-medicating with leftover antibiotics and self-medicating with antibiotics which are required from unauthorized sources. In the United States, you cannot get an antibiotic without a prescription from a licensed medical provider. It is not so in other places outside the U.S. Ragaswamy said improper use of antibiotics can not only cause risk of infection, but it can also put the community at risk for antibiotic resistance and superbugs. If you have a wound, keep it clean until it heals. If you have an infection, ask yourself, is this going to progress to sepsis? And ask your health care provider, he said, adding that those with chronic conditions need to take care of them. Ragaswamy noted that these are things patients can follow to avoid sepsis. If we get ahead of sepsis and if we create enough awareness among the general public and general practitioners about sepsis, we can together conquer sepsis, Ragaswamy said. Conservative banker looks to save prairie chicken. Conservative banker Wayne Walker is on a mission to preserve lesser prairie chicken habitat. Walker, the principal of Common Ground Capital, LLC, said in this case, instead of trying to develop land, they are trying to conserve or restore habitat. His group finds ranchers that have lesser prairie chickens. Common Ground is a small company, and what they do is very niche. But we do other species too. We spend a bunch of money to figure out the birds out there and what we can do to improve their habitat, and we get the land approved by the Fish and Wildlife Service. We sell the mitigation credits to energy industry folks who are trying to offset their impacts, Walker said. Through the years, the lesser prairie chicken has been on and off the endangered species list. It is currently on the list, Walker said. The primary reason we think the prairie chicken and the dune sagebrush lizard and all these critters are in trouble is the ranchers can't get paid enough money to really do things that would help them in a long-term, meaningful way. A lot of the government programs will give him a few dollars an acre to remove some mesquite trees, but then mesquite trees just come back, so you've got energy development out there that pays a lot better than conservation programs, Walker said. He added that you have to propose a proposition with good value that recognizes that ranchers are good stewards and may need more money to improve the habitat. That's what we do. We partner with private dollars and invest private to work with the ranchers, Walker said. For someone drilling a well, Common Ground will calculate how many conservation credits are needed. It's probably going to be several 100 credits because it's not just the physical pad. The vertical structure creates an avoidance zone for prairie chickens. Let's say the well needs 100 credits. You typically mitigate 2 to 1. So if he needs 100 credits, he buys 200 from us. He gets legal protection, and that investment goes to part of a larger area we're trying to serve, to ultimately build a conservation bank out of what they call a stronghold, Walker said. It also includes things like reintroducing prescribed fire in a landscape, taking care of weeds and invasive species, monitoring the prairie chicken and habitat every year, writing annual reports, which are required by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service every year. That's what the endowment does. The rest of it, effectively, we recover our development costs. We split the rest with the landowner, so that's where the money goes, Walker said. The money typically helps keep ranch in the family, and it gets reinvested in paying off debt, buying equipment, or expanding the ranch, he said. What makes his focus on lesser prairie chickens is he spent summers and winter breaks off south of Ozona. My grandmother was a real big wildlife enthusiast and really got me to appreciate nature and why we need nature. It's not just because it's cool animals to look at. We all breathe air and need clean water from nature. That's one thing. The other thing is that I was a wind developer for many years out of Houston, but I cover the Texas Panhandle, West Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, and New Mexico, which just happened to be where the prairie chicken was. This is going back almost 25 years, Walker said. I learned a lot about the prairie chicken. I wasn't trying to learn about it. I just kept running into it, he added. Wind developers, for example, made conservation efforts with Nature Conservancy, but the situation was uncertain. Walker started to learn about conservation banking. I saw the future back in the late 2000s, Walker said. They knew about the Permian Basin and the Mississippi lime play in Kansas and western Oklahoma, plus transmission was exploding. Solar wasn't exploding, he said, but it is now. All of this in these very remote areas, which are the last of the last great places for the prairie chicken, Walker said. Essentially, he said, he works with landowners in places where there are prairie chickens, or they can restore habitat for prairie chickens. We get these ranches approved by the feds, the Fish and Wildlife Services. They approve the ranches and they say, okay, you can sell conservation credits. That's why I call it conservation banking, because we're getting the credits approved in advance of needing to sell them, and we bank those credits. They're ready to sell. Then I go out and I find, mostly right now it's renewable folks who are using solar, wind, transmission, local co-ops who are building in prairie chicken habitats, and they need to offset those impacts. We determine how many credits they need. They enroll in our habitat conservation plan. They get a permit to build their project, and they're in compliance with the law. They are also really good value for the dollar. Doing something actually helps separate chicken, Walker said. I believe the way we get out of this is we got to actually go back grow back prairie chicken habitat. Because right now we are deficient, that will allow us to grow prairie chickens, and once we've increased prairie chickens, we can get away from this whipsaw, listed, not listed, down the road in the Midland Courthouse stuff, he added. In West Texas, eastern New Mexico, there are about 500 lesser prairie chickens as of 2021, but it ranges all the way up to 3,000, which Walker said still isn't good. It's bad. We could have another extended drought or some sort of wildlife disease. They could be gone in a few years, Walker said. He added that the prairie chicken plays a vital role as an indicator of ecosystem health because it needs wide-open, native, intact grasslands. We don't have any of those left, so our overall prairie ecology here is unfortunately not healthy, and you lose the prairie chicken. It's just another sign that we're on a steep decline of grassland ecosystems, Walker said. Obituaries. Sheila Black. Sheila Black, beloved mother, sister, aunt, and friend, passed away peacefully on February 13th. Born in 1952, she lived most of her life in Odessa. She is preceded in death by her parents, Polly and Johnny Glidwell, and Joe Stewart, husband Bob Black, and nephew Jason Stewart. A visitation with family will be held Thursday, February 22nd from 6 to 8 p.m. at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. A memorial service to celebrate Sheila's life will be held on Friday at 2 p.m. also at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. Marcial Hernandez, 96, passed away on Thursday, February 15th. A visitation will be held Tuesday, February 20th at 5 p.m. at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. With rosary starting at 7 p.m., a funeral mass will be at 10 a.m. Wednesday, February 21st at Holy Redeemer Catholic Church. Norman Basil Height. Norman Basil Height of Odessa passed away on January 23rd at his daughter's home in Highland Village. Norman was born in Moran, Texas on September 23rd, 1938 to Basil B. and Leela E. Height. A visitation will be held from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, February 24th at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home, 601 North Allegheny Avenue. A celebration of life will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, February 24th at Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home. Peggy Sue Searcy. Peggy Harris Searcy passed away Friday, February 16th at home after a brief illness. She was born to Ray Harris and Audrey Cummings Harris, February 23rd, 1939, in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico. Family visitation will be at 2 p.m. Friday, February 23rd at Bethany Christian Church. Funeral will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, February 23rd at Bethany Christian Church. Thomas Henry King. No services have been scheduled for Thomas Henry King, 91, of Odessa, who died Thursday, February 15th in Odessa. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Donna Norton Smith. Donna Norton Smith, 66, of Odessa, passed away Monday, February 12th. Graveside services were at 2 p.m. Wednesday, February 21st at Sunset Memorial Gardens in Odessa. Donna was born April 14th, 1957, in Odessa to Donald and Lillian Christine Norton. Christian Nation idea fuels U.S. conservative causes, but historians say it misreads founders' intent. The U.S. Constitution doesn't mention Christianity or any specific religion. The Declaration of Independence famously proclaims that people's rights come from a creator and nature's God, but doesn't specify who that is. Yet large numbers of Americans believe the founders intended the U.S. to be a Christian nation, and many believe it should be one. Such views are especially strong among Republicans and their white evangelical base. Already such views are being voiced by supporters of Donald Trump and his bid to recapture the presidency. The idea of a Christian America means different things to different people. Pollsters have found a wide circle of Americans who hold general God and country sentiments. But within that is a smaller, hardcore group that also check other boxes in surveys, such as that the U.S. Constitution was inspired by God and that the federal government should declare the U.S. a Christian nation, advocate Christian values, or stop enforcing the separation of church and state. For those embracing that package of beliefs, it's more likely they'll have unfavorable views toward immigration, dismiss or downplay the impact of anti-black discrimination, and believe Trump was a good or great president, according to a 2021 Pew Research Center survey. This latter group reflects a movement widely called Christian nationalism, which fuses American and Christian values, symbols, and identity, and seeks to privilege Christianity in public life. The idea of Christian nationhood fills Americans' need for an origin story, a belief that we come here for something special and that we're here for God's work, said Eric McDaniel, an associate professor of government at the University of Texas. It creates a sense of national innocence, so adherents resist confronting uglier parts of the U.S. history, he said. The belief connects to other beliefs, past and present, from the Manifest Destiny doctrine that justified continental conquest to Trump's America First and make America Great Again slogans, said McDaniel, a co-author of the Everyday Crusade, Christian Nationalism in American Politics. Trump has echoed some of these ideas, vowing to bar immigrants who don't like our religion. Some conservatives and Republicans embrace the idea of Christian national origin, even as many reject the Christian nationalist label. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, who proclaimed the America is and was founded as a Christian nation, and that Thomas Jefferson was divinely inspired in his writing of the Declaration of Independence, according to a 2015 sermon that drew wider attention with his recent election as Speaker. Wall Builders, an organization Johnson credits for its profound influence on him, has spread materials claiming that revisionist historians have downplayed America's Christian origins. But the group has been widely criticized for historically dubious claims. A lawsuit on its behalf is challenging the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority's refusal to run its bus ads touting the purported belief of founders. Vocal supporters of Trump have described current politics as spiritual warfare for the destiny of a country that former Trump aide Steve Bannon described as the New Jerusalem, and conservative activist Charlie Kirk said was founded by courageous Bible-believing Christians. Recent Texas, Oklahoma, and Kentucky Republican Party platforms proclaim the country was founded on Judeo-Christian principles. The Reverend Robert Jeffress, pastor of the First Baptist Church of Dallas, said he doesn't identify as a Christian nationalist, but believe America was founded on as a Christian nation. I'm not claiming that all of our founders were Christians, he said in an interview. Some were deists, some were atheists, but the majority were Christians. I'm also not saying that non-Christians shouldn't have the same rights as Christians in our country. But he said, there's a case to be made that the Judeo-Christian faith was the foundation of our laws and many of our principles. He cited founder John Jay, the first Supreme Court Chief Justice, asserting it was Americans' duty in our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. Jeffrey said he doesn't believe America is privileged by God, but as with any nation, God will continue to bless America to the extent that we follow him. Anthea Butler, chair of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania, said, "History precludes any idea of a Christian nation. It doesn't mean that Christians weren't part of the founding of this nation," said Butler, an historian of African American and American religion. "What it does mean is that if you believe that America is a Christian nation and you happen to subscribe to Christian nationalism as part of that, you're buying into a myth. That America as a Christian nation idea is trope of exclusion," she said. "Centered American history on white Anglo-Saxon Protestants as the ones that are willing and should be running the country both then and now. That justifies viewing others as heathens, including the enslaved blacks and the Native Americans whose land has been taken. Those arguing for a Christian America are generally not historians and not really talking about history. They're talking politics," said John Fay, author of the 2011 book, "Was America Founded as a Christian Nation?" They appeal to a false view of the founding, or at least a partial view of the founding, to advance political agendas of the present, said Fay, a history professor at Messiah University, a Christian university in Mechanicsburg, Pennsylvania. "These agendas are built on a very weak historical foundation. The belief in America's Christian origins is mainstream. 6 to 10 U.S. adults said the founders intended America to be a Christian nation, according to a 2022 Pew Research Center survey. About 45% said the U.S. should be a Christian nation. 4 in 5 white and evangelical Protestants agreed with that assertion. By some measures, Democratic President Joe Biden might be seen in that category, citing the importance of his Catholic faith and calling for God's blessing on America and its troops, but also invoking shared values, whether you're Christian, whether you're Jewish, Hindu, Muslim, Buddhist, or any other faith, or no faith at all. 1/3 of U.S. adults surveyed in 2013 said God intended America to be a promised land for European Christians to set an example to the world, according to a Public Religion Research Institute Brookings report. Such surveys have found a smaller, more ardent group of believers in Christian nationhood. In other surveys, PRRI identified about 10% of Americans as the most committed adherents. The Constitution prohibits any religious test for office, and its First Amendment bars congressional establishment of any religion, along with guaranteeing free exercise of religion. Defenders of Christian nationhood can point out that several of the 13 original states funded Protestant churches at their origins, though within a few decades, all had followed Virginia's example in halting the practice. They can point to Christian rhetoric by some founders such as John Jay, Patrick Henry, and Samuel Adams. But several key founders would never pass a test for orthodoxy. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Benjamin Franklin viewed Jesus as a great teacher, but not as God. Could you find stuff where John Adams talks about religion being the foundation of the Republic, like George Washington said in his farewell address, said Fay. Are there states where Christianity was privileged? Yes, you can find all those things. You can also find things to show that the Constitution wants to keep religion and government separate. Some secular activists today advocate for an opposite law that U.S. founders sought to banish religion from public life. Fay said that also goes too far. When you're dealing with the 18th century, nuance and complexity,
Texas ban on university
diversity efforts provides a glimpse of the future across GOP-led states. The dimming lighting and vacant offices were the first clues. Other changes struck Nina Washington, a senior at the University of Texas, when she returned to her favorite study spot from winter break. The word Multicultural Center had been taken off the wall, erasing an effort began in the late 1980s to serve historically marginalized communities on campus. The center staff members were gone, its group, student groups dissolved. Politics, behaviors, and emotions are returning to the old ways, said Washington, who is a Black woman, found a sense of community at the center. The void in the heart of the nearly 52,000 student campus is one of many changes rippling across college campuses in Texas, where one of the nation's most sweeping bans of diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives took effect January 1st. At least five other states have passed their own bans, and Republican lawmakers in at least 19 states are pursuing various restrictions on diversity initiatives, an issue they hope will mobilize their voters this election year. With over 600,000 students enrolled at more than 30 public universities across the state, the rollout in Texas offers a large-scale glimpse of what lies ahead for public higher education. Without the initiatives designed to make minorities feel less isolated and white students more prepared for careers that require working effectively with people of different backgrounds. At the University of Texas's flagship campus in Austin, the state's second most populous public university, only 4.5% of the student population is Black and 25.2% is Hispanic, numbers some students fear will drop as they struggle to adjust to an atmosphere of fear about what they can say and do. The law signed by Republican Governor Greg Abbott bans public higher education institutes from influencing hiring practices with respect to race, sex, color, or ethnicity, and prohibits promoting differential or preferential treatment or special benefits for people based on these categories. Also forbidden are training and activities conducted in reference to race, color, ethnicity, gender identity, or sexual orientation. Republican State Senator Brandon Crichton, who authored the bill, said in an email comment Tuesday that DEI efforts claim they are meant to increase diversity, but after close examination, they are an effort to inject politics and promote cancel culture into our colleges and universities. Time will tell. The Texas Higher Education Coordinating Board, whose 9 members are appointed by the governor, is required to inform lawmakers every 2 years about the ban's impact on admissions, academic progress, and graduation rates of students by race, sex, and ethnicity. To comply with the law, the cultural identity centers that admissions offices promoted to attract minorities are now closed. University websites have scrubbed any references to diversity and inclusion, replacing them with access and community engagement. Staff have been reassigned new roles. People want to keep their jobs, but many of us were trained to do this work around diversity, inclusion, and equity, and were hired specifically to do that, said Patrick Smith, vice president of the Texas Faculty Association. Professors are fearful, editing their syllabi and watching their speech as they navigate the boundaries of compliance, Smith said. As for the Multicultural Center in the Student Union on the Austin campus, the university announced it will consider how to best use the space to continue building communities for all Longhorns. Meanwhile, although the law explicitly exempts academics, uncertainty over its scope also has professors and students wondering how to comply. To know that your speech is monitored and basically censored if you do the kind of work I do, that's a strange feeling, said Karma Chavez, a professor of Mexican-American and Latin-A students at the university. The Hispanic Faculty Association, of which Chavez is the co-president, has been prohibited from meeting during working hours or using campus spaces without paying a fee. They can't even communicate through university emails. The group affiliated with the university cannot co-sponsor events with them. The limits would have Chavez catching herself in meetings or when mentoring a student before she speaks on race or ethnicity because she is unsure of what she can say and when. I don't think I am self-censoring. I think I've been censored by the state legislature, Chavez said. University officials shuttered a group aimed at providing resources for students who qualified for the Federal Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Chavez said the DACA group wasn't specifically helping any of the classifications of people, so it tells you how widely, how extensively they are interpreting the law. Some student groups whose university funding has been prohibited are struggling with the financial burden of maintaining their identity communities and continuing cultural traditions. University of Texas senior Christian Mira, financial officer for the Queer, Trans, Black, Indigenous People of Color Agency, said the group lost its space in the Multicultural Center and has been aggressively fundraising through alumni, local supporters, and community outreach. They hope to keep supporting a lively community of students with signature events, including a block party, membership institutes, and a ball, although they're not sure where. College is already a difficult experience, so having people around you who you depend on to have that kind of community, it made students feel safe. It made students feel like they could succeed on campus, Mira said. Alexander De Jesus, who attends UT Dallas and is an advocate with Texas Students for DEI, said they prepared for months in ways big and small, such as more clearly advertising that anyone can use a closet of clothes frequented by students who are transitioning. It has also been stressful telling other students, hey, keep your head up, De Jesus said. It is difficult to say that when you see a climate of fear developing and when you see people who are justifiably angered about traditional pathways or politics or people not listening to them.
Our View, Lies Everywhere as Election Approaches, by Odessa American, February 16th, 2024. Sometimes it's difficult to know where to start. So many lies, so many distortions, so much ugliness. Guess we'll just dig in and try to get to the bottom of the pile of manure. On January 31st, Jamie Tisdale, on the Odessa Accountability Facebook page, posted a list of 32 accomplishments completed by the folks of Ector County Republican Chairwoman Tisha Crowe helped put on the City Council. She said she doesn't mind reporting the facts and called the list indisputable. Listed at number 28, successfully won all lawsuits filed against the city, none currently pending. We guess Tisdale doesn't know the difference between winning and settling. The Odessa American reported just 4 months ago that the city of Odessa paid out nearly $465,000 to settle three lawsuits, all involving traffic collisions. One of the lawsuits involved the death of three teenagers and cost the city $500,000. Worse yet, former Assistant City Manager Aaron Smith's whistleblower lawsuit against the city is still alive and well in Ector County District Court. Tisdale may have forgotten him, but we're sure you haven't. He's the guy who claims he was fired because he had the audacity to ask various law enforcement agencies to investigate whether Mayor Javier Hoven violated the Texas Open Meetings Act when the council fired City Manager Michael Marrero and City Attorney Natasha Brooks in December 2022. He also asked them to investigate the legality of Hoven signing a contract with 12 professional consulting services without first presenting it to the full City Council for consideration. A quick online check of Ector County District Court records also shows at least three other pending lawsuits against the city. Indisputable? Number 23 on the list appointed responsible board members to the Odessa Development Corporation, who said no to giving Nacero $2 million for promised incentives because they did not comply with contractual agreement. According to a May 24, 2023 letter from Nacero's Wesley Burnett, they didn't even ask for their second incentive payment because they knew they weren't going to meet their obligations. They met 98% their first year and were given their $2 million. We would like to make sure that the city and ODC do not expend time or funds in performing an audit of the last year. This would be a waste of time and dollars that could be allotted to other areas, Burnett wrote. We continue to work hard and we are striving to attain the goals for the third year of the agreement. Again, indisputable facts. Making number three on Tisdale's list was overhauling the court after more than $1 million worth of citations were written off. Now we don't know how many citations have been written off or even the amount of those citations. What we do know, however, is that former court director Kimberly Joswiak told us state law dictates specific cases may be deemed uncollectible by the court after 15 years. They weren't indiscriminately closed without authority and, in fact, outside auditors told city officials it was detrimental for cities to carry so much uncollectible debt on their books, Joswiak told us. Number seven. On the list, restructured all city departments and set them on zero-based budgets, making them more efficient and cutting wasteful spending. We guess Tisdale didn't take a gander at the FY23-24 budget for the city. The general fund expenditures for the year are nearly $14 million higher than last year. We actually reported in August how much each department's budget had increased. Precious few departments had their budgets cut. We're really befuddled by number 32 on Tisdale's list. Deposited to the bank several million dollars that was in the city's safe when they terminated former city manager Michael Marrero. Wouldn't you think that it was truly the case there'd be some mention of it during all the American Rescue Plan Act discussions held recently? Hey, guess what, citizens of Odessa? We just found millions of dollars and we're going to spend it to fix A, B, and C roads and X, Y, and Z at the wastewater plant. We can spend some ARPA money here instead. Isn't that great news? We haven't heard anything of the kind. Moreover, when we filed a Texas Public Information Act request for any memos, emails, text, or documents about this huge discovery, we didn't receive a single item in response. Nada, zip, zilch. We don't believe there were millions found. Number six, pulled the plug on $10 million worth of frivolous pet projects. Okay, what projects? Really? Haven't heard anything of that kind during council meetings. We also find it curious that these fake news sites are consistently praising Hoven and council members Denise Swanner and Mark Mata for getting back to the basics, for focusing on infrastructure, 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 while crucifying past councils for neglecting your roads, sewer, water, and basic city maintenance for decades. But let's take a look at some of the numbers the city of Odessa provided us following a Texas Public Information Act request. The 2020 budget for the water treatment plant was $5.4 million compared to $4.9 million this year. The 2020 budget for the wastewater treatment plant was $5.7 million. This year's budget, $4.6 million. We don't know about you, but we're not seeing a tremendous amount of difference between the city council of old and today's council. The repairs and equipment budgets tell a different story, especially when it comes to the wastewater treatment plant. The repairs and equipment budget for the water treatment plant jumped from $146,427 to $306,950 between 2020 and 2024. But what's even more eye-opening is what has happened with the wastewater treatment plant. Last month, Councilmember Mark Mata said it appears as though regularly scheduled maintenance was never performed at the plant after hearing a dire report from some consultants. Everything that moves is going to have to be replaced, so why has it waited 40 frickin' years for it to get like this before, I mean, we can do it every 2 years, replace these valves, replace these motors. It's just mind-boggling, Mata said. Remember, Hoven, Mata, and Swanner were sworn into office in January 2021. According to city records, the repairs and equipment budget for the wastewater treatment plant was just under $1.3 million in 2020. It fell in 2021 to just under $905,000, then to $838,000 in 2022, and back up to $844,000 in 2023. This year, the repairs and equipment budget for the wastewater treatment plant is $664,050. So who exactly is to blame for the crumbling wastewater plant? Note to selves, ask for street department budgets to see if similar story can be told. Now back to Tisdale's list of accomplishments. Number 4, pass a no-mask vaccine mandate. Number 9, bringing a sports complex to Odessa. Number 6, establishing a free diabetes awareness clinic. Number 18, brought back the National Day of Prayer. Number 19, made Odessa a sanctuary city for the unborn. While a sports complex may eventually bring money into Odessa through tournaments and ultimately be a very good thing for the area, isn't it funny how the Hovind Sweiner and Mata cabal never miss a chance to take a swipe at the public-private venture that is the Marriott, but are all in on the sports complex? Public-private venture? We like the sports complex idea, but must ask, what does it have to do with infrastructure? Oh, and here's another thought on the sports complex. In another of her posts, Tisdale complains former city council spent more than $10 million remodeling the Ector Theater. So how's the sports complex any different? Aren't both intended to draw visitors in so they'll spend more money on hotels, food, and shops? And yes, we absolutely agree diabetes is a horrible disease that affects too many. And yes, we agree we're in dire need of a regional behavioral health facility. Tisdale didn't list the $1 million the city recently gave Medical Center Hospital for that project, but we know from other posts she's a fan. But aren't Hovind and co. talking out of both sides of their mouths? If the city is really in dire straits when it comes to our water, sewers, and our roads, and we have no reason to doubt it, why did they just give a combined $1.5 million to the diabetes clinic and mental health facility? Take another look at those repairs and equipment budgets and go back and read our January 13th story on the wastewater treatment plant and tell us what the city's priorities should be. And if you agree with the cabal, fine. Just don't go around bragging about the council being hyper-focused on infrastructure and don't criticize the good old boys for pet projects. And you can't say the diabetes clinic isn't a pet project. Mayor Hovind has shared many times he has diabetes. Perhaps most vexing to us, though, are numbers 4, 18, and 19. Not only do these things have nothing to do with roads, sewer, and water, but whatever happened to separation of church and state? Why are we having our city's legal department spend hours researching and writing mandates, resolutions, and ordinances on such items? Don't they have better things to do? Maybe if they weren't spending time on these things, the city wouldn't have to spend so much on outside counsel. Remember, we've reported the city of Odessa spent $511,265.92 last year on outside counsel, blowing their budget by $411,000. We're past COVID, thank goodness. The state is already a sanctuary state for the unborn, and people are already going to pray on the first Thursday in May, or not, really. We are sick to death of all the "we are more Christian conservative than everyone else," not because we don't love our brothers and sisters in faith, but because religion has no place in politics. We honestly believe the Crow cabal has taken a page out of the playbook of some national figures and is using fear to remain in control. Remember, we once reported about cabal member Jeff Russell, who is again running for a local GOP party precinct chair slot, sending an email to Hovind, Mata, and Sweiner about a controversial Taylor, Texas Christmas parade. He wrote, "This is unreal but shows, in vivid colors, what we're fighting for. Christian conservatives must work for control of every level of government because the crazy anti-God leftists are striving for control. Nowadays, the squad is also fighting against rhinos and what they like to call trans Republicans." Again and again, Tisdale is pointing out who is a Christian conservative while shamelessly promoting them on her propaganda Facebook site. She's also pointing out that some of the opposition have been involved in politics before, while at the same time, oddly enough, arguing that they're part of the good old boys. So let's say that's actually true. They haven't been involved in politics. Why is that such a horrible thing? Perhaps they were too busy up until now to run. Maybe they were too intimidated until now to run. Maybe they didn't feel like they had the support they needed until now. Who knows? The point is, we should be applauding them for running now. Maybe, just maybe, they'll have some fresh ideas. And maybe, just maybe, they'll be honest, ethical, and dare we say, kind and truthful individuals.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Oil Report on the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, February 17th. New Frontiers, Midway Energy Building Exploration Production Company. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. A new exploration and production company is headed to Midland, and its founders all have roots in the Permian Basin. Quote, "I and my partners have worked in the Permian Basin, and we feel we have the right combination of experience," Jack Walter, who serves as Chief Executive Officer of Midway Energy Partners, said. Walter is joined by Brady Adams, Chief Operating Officer, and Jordan Cox, Senior Vice President, Engineering, in establishing the company. Midway recently closed on an equity commitment from investment funds managed by Post Oak Energy Capital. Speaking with the Reporter-Telegram by telephone, Walter acknowledged there are challenges in finding assets to acquire and develop in the Permian Basin today. That is why Midway is turning its attention to overlooked or underutilized assets as it gets up and running. Quote, "We are actively looking all over the Permian Basin," he said. "The company favors horizontal assets, but looks at all possibilities," he said. Quote, "Our goal is to build an operating company," Walter stated. "We plan to earn our returns through the drill bit, so we plan to get a rig up quickly," end quote. He and his team are aware of the challenges in the Permian Basin and find it a unique time to be in both the oil and gas industry and in the Permian Basin. Quote, "Oil and gas people are the best group of people. They're hardworking, entrepreneurial people," Walter said. "We're also excited about attracting young people. The industry is not as cool and shiny as it was, but if you look over the past 20 years, there's been a ton of innovation. Everything has changed, and I see incredible innovation coming in the future," end quote. Seismicity, wells add to water reuse challenges. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Forecasts have Texas facing a severe water shortage as the state's water supply could fall 18%, while demand rises 9% by 2070. At the same time, experts are forecasting there will be a surplus of twice that amount in water associated with oil and natural gas production. Quote, "There is a trajectory where we're looking at the high end of what communities will have to pay for water, matching the high end of what companies pay for water disposal," said Laura Kapper, president and chief executive officer of Energy Makers Advisory Group. Kapper, who spoke on panels discussing seismicity, as well as a panel discussing best practices in disposal wellbores, told the Reporter-Telegram in a telephone interview, "The solution is to find additional ways of using that produced water beyond oil and gas operations, agriculture, for instance, or aquifer recharge, or ultimately for municipal use. The technology exists," she says, "but the challenge is getting the costs where they need to be. Regulators must also scramble to keep up with the rapid pace of innovation in water treatment," she added. There seems to be more of an appetite in Texas for promoting produced water reuse and recycling, and the state has become more aggressive in pushing forward with those efforts, she said. The Railroad Commission has been challenged to address increased seismicity linked with water injection, but Kapper said experts are getting better at seeing fault patterns and correlating seismic events so they can devise better policies. She added that there could be other factors besides water injection volumes, rates, or pressures that could induce earthquakes. Quote, "You can't make one rule for the Permian Basin and apply it even-handedly. There are differences in geology, minerals, pressures," she said. There's also the issue of uncontrolled water wells, as seen in Crane County recently. Kapper said, quote, "It's not today's wells that are the problem. They are very solidly constructed to last for decades or a century. But those high volumes and pressures are operating in the same vicinity as old infrastructure from the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, or even 1960s. This new dynamic and weakened old infrastructure are heightening concerns," end quote. Extracting minerals from water Advancing in Oil Industry. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Oil and natural gas producers, who see millions of barrels of water produced alongside their oil and gas, are increasingly wanting to do more than merely pump the water back underground or treat it and use it in subsequent operations. Companies are conducting pilot projects testing technology to extract critical minerals like lithium from the water. Quote, "It starts with economics," said Kyle Murray, principal scientist with Murray Geo Consulting. Speaking with the Reporter Telegram after participating in a panel discussion at the Produced Water Society's recent conference in Houston, Murray says most oil and gas producers are seeking to do something economically efficient and viable with that produced water. Extracting critical minerals, quote, "is a way to offset the cost of treatment and generate additional revenue," he said. "The water is already at the surface, so why not extract minerals and add value?" End quote. The effort has both economic and environmental benefits. Murray pointed out that the U.S. imports anywhere from 75% to 100% of critical elements like lithium, quote, "so finding a domestic source is essential to ensure the security of needed resources as demand increases," end quote. The new technologies also promise to be more environmentally friendly than the strip mining and use of water sources employed in the countries currently providing those minerals. "Extraction technology is readily available," Murray said, "but the economics need to be better understood. Two, supplies must be matched with end users, and transportation logistics need to be understood and refined." His main business line is characterization of produced water, and he has worked extensively sampling and analyzing Permian Basin produced water, identifying lithium and 60 other constituents. He also works throughout the mid-continent. As more data on the economics of extracting those minerals is gathered, he expects more companies will join the effort. Two, he said, "extraction is part of the process towards use of produced water outside the oil industry. Not only is it a source of critical minerals, it can augment fresh water," end quote. Produced water management, key to decarbonization. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Nations around the world are moving towards decarbonization of energy. But that goal won't be met without contributions from the oil and gas industry and the water produced alongside crude and natural gas, especially in the Permian Basin. Quote, "Produced water is going to play a big role in future plans for decarbonization and emissions reduction," said Rob Bruant, director of product with B3 Insights. "One of the ways is if you inject carbon dioxide and store it underground," he told the Reporter Telegram in a telephone interview after he participated in a panel discussion on the subject at the Produced Water Society's conference in Houston recently. "That means two things," he said. "Water will have to be pulled from underground to make room for that CO2, and ways must be found to manage water produced not from oil and gas, but from CO2 injection. Second," he said, "the experience and expertise gained around produced water management and disposal will be extraordinarily important." Quote, "The issues facing the Permian Basin with water injection and disposal will be the same around CO2 injection and storage," Bruant said. "Those operating CO2 injection sites will also have to pay attention to induced seismicity and pressure changes associated with that injection." Quote, "In order to rapidly accelerate CO2 injection and storage without environmental harm, lessons learned in managing produced water must be relied upon, he said. Producing low-carbon fuels certified as being produced with zero emissions will be another arrow in our quiver, he said. There is also talk about transitioning to hydrogen energy, and Bruant pointed out that generating hydrogen requires large volumes of water. Again, produced water from oil and natural gas operations could provide that water, he said. The technical expertise associated with producing oil and gas and water will be fundamental to providing reliable, secure energy while transitioning to low-carbon or net-zero carbon energy, he concluded. Here is the Dear Abby column that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, February 22nd. Mother-in-law serves up complaints with dinner. Dear Abby, my husband and I have been married 3 years, and we generally trade off spending holidays with each of our families. Because neither set of our parents is willing to travel to us, we go to them. My mother-in-law takes great pride in hosting and sets a beautiful table. She'll spend an entire day in the kitchen, foregoing visiting with guests and wearing herself out to present an amazing dinner. If this brought her pleasure, there wouldn't be a problem. But Abby, she complains bitterly about how tired she is, how much her feet hurt, how much work it is to have people in her home, and how she resents it. The thing is, she won't let us help. I've offered each time to help her cook, bring dishes made ahead of time, or take a turn so she can sit down. Each time, I have been sternly rebuffed, as if I've asked something embarrassing. When I tried leading the cleanup crew, her response was a hard no. I even suggested I come a day early and help with prep work, also no. I'm pretty sure she tells her friends she has lazy kids. Suggestions? Signed, Baffled in Pennsylvania. Dear Baffled, your mother-in-law appears to love to suffer. She is a martyr, so please stop attempting to deprive her of her pleasure. Try as you will, and have, you can't change her. Of course, you and her son could offer to take her and Dad out for a lovely dinner. If you haven't already experienced enough rejection from the woman, you could give it a try. But don't be surprised if she refuses the offer or takes this personally. What she may say to her friends about you should not affect you. Dear Abby, I'd like your opinion regarding the financial help I give my sister. When her husband passed 18 months ago, it was clear she needed some help each month. I've been sending her $200, which I can afford for now. My husband and I are on Social Security. 8 months ago, she took in an old acquaintance for the purpose of collecting room rent. Turns out he can't or won't work, and she is supporting him now, as well as sharing her bed. Also, their past relationship was disastrous. Both of them were alcoholics at the time. She has now resumed drinking with them, after having quit a few years ago. Abby, I don't want my dislike for her lifestyle to impact my financial help, but on the other hand, I feel I'm being taken advantage of. Should I keep sending her money? Signed, Sour Sister in Illinois. Dear Sister, have a talk with Sissy. Tell her you have been sending her money because you felt she needed it after the death of her husband. Then remind her that she has a new partner in her home, her life, and her bed, and he should be contributing, which is why you will no longer be sending her money. She needs to hear it.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.